Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's Pat Moore hosting today on Juno Afternoon. I'm going to be talking with some wonderful guests this afternoon. Dixie Hood will drop in to tell us about her Right for Your Life program. Lou Logan will be here to talk about the deadline for the August showings of the Jump Society. End of July is the deadline. We'll have some folks here from the Get Out the Boat campaign telling us about getting the boats out in the water, sailing on Sundays. Our Wednesdays, and Mark Wheeler will be here with the mudroom presentation. Weather looks like rain. Highs around 55. Rain likely tonight. Rain likely tomorrow. Rain likely Wednesday. Are we bored yet?
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today in our health and wellness series, an Alaska Native physician talks about incorporating culture into physical activity. Dr. Ted Mala is with the Alaska Native Health Corporation South Central Foundation. He's the director of traditional healing, where traditional and Western medicines are incorporated. Mala says the outreach to youth is physical, spiritual, and mental, and he says it's important to incorporate total health at an early age.
We have a wonderful RAISE program where we take youth from 14 to 17 years old. We take them out all summer. We expose them to many activities. They work side by side with us. But the physical part includes subsistence activities. They go and they pull fishnets. In a lot of our places where I'm from, in Buckland, near Kotzebue area, you'll see lots of these things out where we don't have roads. We don't have running water or bathrooms or whatever, but we have lots of physical activity. I can tell you that if you go to Kotzebue today, you will see at 2 in the morning, you'll see a softball game. You will see kids out everywhere doing physical things. On the Aleutian Islands, we have people that during the school year, their physical activity includes native dancing.
Mala says traditional plants and native foods are healing. He says South Central Foundation has a traditional garden and a book on native foods that includes how to cook seal, how to get a walrus, and how to prepare caribou. Mala was on a White House panel recently celebrating 1 year of the First Lady's Let's Move in Indian Country initiative, which focuses on youth. Panelists included healthcare workers, athletes, and others who are making progress in creating healthy tribal communities. Outreach and prevention in tribal communities plays a part in health and wellness in Indian Country. Fareen Williams is a prevention outreach specialist with the White Mountain Apache Tribe Rainbow Treatment Center in Arizona. She says some of the issues tribal members are facing include substance abuse and suicide. Williams says the treatment center offers a number of services, including after-hours and residential or outpatient treatment. She says an important part of mental and behavioral health is educating the community about services provided.
What I started off was a family night that takes place on a Wednesday night, and I bring in different families, people that don't have a job. I provide transportation services for them, and then I even feed them dinner. I bring in speakers from different departments because these people don't have a job. They don't have transportation to get to where they want to be at. So I try to bring in all that information into Rainbow Treatment Center so they can utilize their services as well. And then I go out into parenting class and I work with the parenting class. And out there I promote Rainbow Treatment Center.
Williams focused on Indian Country wellness and health recently at a conference in New Mexico. On this day in 1975, gunfire broke out between members of the American Indian Movement and federal agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Two agents were killed during the incident. AIM member Leonard Peltier was later convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life terms for the deaths of the agents. The 67-year-old is imprisoned at the Coleman Federal Correctional Complex in Florida. Peltier's next parole hearing is scheduled for 2024. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
I'm Billy Mills. As a grandfather and Olympic athlete, I know the importance of keeping kids healthy. The Children's Health Insurance Program in your state can provide your child additional health coverage, such as dental care, vision care, and emergency services. Enrolling your child can also help maximize health resources at your travel clinic. To learn more, contact your clinic or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW or visit insurekidsnow.gov.
Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Well, let's give that weather forecast a little more of a once-over and see if we can make some sense out of it here. It says rain, the highs today around 55, and southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. And then tonight it says rain. I'm getting that same feeling that it's going to say that all the way through. Lows around 48, southeast winds 5 miles per hour. Wednesday, rain likely, highs around 56. Is there a difference between rain and rain likely? I'm not sure. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, so it's getting better. Thursday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. And Thursday night through Saturday night, mostly cloudy, chance of rain again. And then Sunday through Monday, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. So it looks like it's going to be a Juno week, which I guess one would say we almost deserve after that wonderful thing that we had for a couple, 3 days last week.
It happened on a weekend.
85 degrees. I could not believe that I was lying on my front lawn on my hammock thinking California thoughts the whole way through. The other voice you just heard speak in there is, of course, Dixie Hood, who is the instigator of a group at the Valley Library that meets, I think, weekly called Write for Your Life. And I don't mean W-E-A-K, I mean W-E-E-K, once a week. And Dixie's here to talk a little bit about her Write for Your Life group. Dixie, how'd you get started with this?
Well, I've always really enjoyed writing. When I was a Girl Scout, I wrote a play for our troop to act out, and all the way through elementary and high school, I enjoyed the English classes the most, and my English teachers were always the favorites, and I was always encouraged, and I started to major in journalism when I got to college age, and then I got married, had a family, and it was years and years and years before I did any serious writing again. But then I went back to school and kept on writing, was a psych major and an English minor, and I was really close to an aunt who was on a dairy ranch. I lived with my aunt and uncle my senior year in high school at Petaluma. And when she moved to an assisted living setup, she had macular degeneration. She could not see very well, but they had a reading and writing program there. And so she talked about all her memories of family life growing up and the pet cats and all sorts of things. And because she wasn't able to write it very well, she had it all taped, and her older daughter transcribed it, printed it all up into a booklet, and she gave it to her family members as a gift at Christmas time. And when I went to visit her down there in the Bay Area, I looked at it, and my dad was included in a lot of the stories. I asked if I could make a copy of it, and she said, sure. And so I took it to Kinko's and then came back to Juno with the idea in mind that I really wanted to put together some memoir essays for my family. And her collection was kind of like a bunch of 1- and 2-page essays. It wasn't really like an autobiography starting off, well, I was born here, and then I did this, and then I did that. But it was just the whole collection of memories, and so that was the idea that I had. And I I started looking for a place to do some writing. And at that time, I saw in the Juno Empire that there was a column, a round town column, that listed a writing group at the Valley Library. And there was a name, Dixie, and a phone number that I recognized. And I thought, aha, that's Dixie Belcher. And so I showed up for one of the meetings, and there were about 8 people there, and they were all sharing things that they'd written. And so then I wrote some things and shared them. And the idea was not to critique them, but to be encouraging, give feedback about things, and really help people be motivated to keep on writing. And so all through the fall and winter and early spring, I was doing that, really enjoying it. And then pretty soon everybody was sort of scattering for the summer, working on the ferry and going on travel and stuff. And so the group kind of came to a wind down place, and it was kind of discussed when it would pick up again. They said, well, maybe in the winter when it's wet and dark and everything, that's the best time to have the writing group. So that's what I looked forward to. But it didn't happen. I don't know what people decided to do instead, but I started looking around for a group that I could go to someplace or gather up some writing contacts. And I looked at courses at the university, continuing ed and stuff, but that seemed too formal. Then I saw in the Round Town column again that there was a writing group that was happening at the downtown library. So I went to that, and it was very different than the one that Dixie had facilitated. There were about 10 or 12 people there, and they were all really pretty hardcore writers wanting to be professionals, and we were all supposed to make a copy for each person that was there of anything that we wrote. And then when it was passed around, taking turns, each person kind of got it all scribbled up with red lines and blue markers and things. And then they went around the table commenting on what was wrong with the grammar here, or you didn't explain that. And you had to keep your mouth shut. You couldn't say anything. So I listened to a dozen people kind of picking things apart, and that was the way the group went. And I thought, well, I tried it for 2 months, and then I thought, oh, this isn't what I had in mind at all. So then I decided I'd start my own group at the Valley Library, because that's where I live, out off the Back Loop Road, so that was closer. And so I started the writing group, and I saw this magazine article, and the title of it was Write for Your Life. And I really liked that. I thought that was a really cool title, and so that's what I decided to call the group. And so I was included in the Around Town column, and people started showing up, and what I listed was, you know, anybody that wanted to share a poem or a memoir or a chapter of a book or a letter that they had written and saved, or anything like that. So people started coming, and some had things with them, and some listened for a while, and I said, it's okay to come even if you don't have anything written that you have ready to share yet, and you can listen to what somebody else has written. And it's just a way of motivating all of us who enjoy writing to keep on doing it. And I'm not going to name a bunch of names. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But there was a woman whose family was in the grocery business forever, and she decided to write up something for the state archives about the history in Juneau of the grocery business. And she got information from other people, and she worked on that. And then somebody else was writing poetry they had always really liked to write poetry. And I was working away on my memoirs. And then a woman came, and she said that she had had a writing group at her home for a while, but she always had to clean her house the day they were coming over, and they expected to have something to eat, and it was just too much work to get ready for them. So she decided she was going to quit that and come to the library. And she wrote lyrics to a gospel song. She said she had belonged to one church previously and then had shifted to a different denomination, and she wanted to change the words. And she'd written the music herself also. And so she said that she'd like to share the words. And I asked her if she would be willing to sing them to us, since that's what it was for. And she says, sure. So that's what she did. And everybody just clapped their hands. They loved that. So it's really been a place to support creativity and good humor and encourage people to keep on writing. And sometimes there's a bunch of kids during the summer that want to come too with their parents. Some of the teachers or parents come with kids, and that's been a fun thing. But even if sometimes I'm the only one there, I just use it as a time to write.
So this is held at the Valley Library.
The Valley Library on Wednesday, every Wednesday from 11 to 12.
Okay, so a Wednesday's from 11 to 12. We're just almost out of time.
Okay.
Do they need to just show up, or can they contact you or anything?
Usually in the paper it's listed as a Wednesday activity, and it has my name and phone number, and
okay,
that's 7892068.
Okay.
And is there time for me to read something?
Unfortunately,
no?
Not today.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry.
Well,
I wrote
a poem that I used as testimony at an assembly meeting. And I thought that I wrote it at the group and
well,
shared
we will
it
have
there
to hear it on another occasion.
Okay.
I'm very sorry that we can't hear it today. Thank you so much for telling us about the group,
oh,
and I'm sure people will be interested
well,
in coming out.
Well, I really look forward to having some new faces and new writing there.
Well,
thanks,
I hope
Pat.
So. The Valley Library, Wednesdays, 11 to 12. Thanks
yes
for telling us.
Paperback, right, paperback.
To reiterate, Dixie Hood's writing group meets Wednesdays at the Valley Library. If you're interested, show up at 11 o'clock. If you want to bring a sample, that's fine. If you don't have a sample of what you're writing, then hang around and listen to the folks who do. My next two guests are in a different way of communicating. This is visual communications. The Jump Society is a wonderful opportunity for people to do independent video and film production here in Juneau. And with me are Pat Race and Lou Logan, and they're talking about deadlines for August's jump showing, right?
It's the deadline is July 26th.
Right.
I think that's a Thursday.
Uh-huh. 1 month from today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
How convenient.
Yeah.
So you have 1 month to give us a video for our screening. It'll be the first weekend of August. I think that's the second, but I might be wrong.
Okay. So yeah. First weekend in August is the actual when it goes up on the screen in the show. So these are is there a time limit? Are there production qualities you're looking for?
Yeah, the time limit is – actually, that's our only real big rule, is that our time limit is 10 minutes or less.
Okay.
And actually, we prefer the movies to be shorter. There are a lot of really good films that fall in the 3 to 5 minute range. It's nice to be able to get as much up there as possible and to share a lot of the films that people in the community are creating, because there's such a breadth in it. Occasionally, we'll include longer ones, but very rarely, and have to be really, really, really good.
So animated actors?
Yeah, everything.
You don't care.
Like live action,
okay.
Adult content, we'll take anything. And generally what we do is we try to arrange the show in such a way that if there is adult content, we'll put that towards the end so that people can leave early. We can say like, okay, the last few films have a few swear words in it, so you might want to take your kids out if you're there. But generally the festival is pretty tame, and it's a great way to look at the community. It's like a snapshot of... it's a very interesting way to see what people are thinking about in the community. Every once in a while you'll get like, oh gosh, there's a lot of zombie films this time around, or there was a lot of environmental films, or there was a lot of ski and snowboarding films, and you can sort of see where the communal mindset is heading.
How did this thing get started?
This is our 10th anniversary. This festival will be. We started... as a way to screen our own films. We make short films, and it's hard to get people together to watch a movie that's 5 minutes long. So so we thought, gosh, we should get some other people together and make a festival out of it. And so it became a festival of locally made short films. That was actually... We all went to school up in Fairbanks at the University of Alaska, and that's kind of where it started. Lou here was a big part of launching the UAF Film Club, and they held a lot of festivals too.
So 10 years ago, let's see, that would have been Super 8 and some 16mm, or were we doing video 10 years ago?
No, this is all video.
It's all video.
We would digitize what wasn't digital, and then we'd generally put it onto a couple mini DV tapes. So it was tape. We're still running on tape, but it was digital tape, and we jumped through a lot. We had a lot of craziness trying to make it work, always getting different formats, and it's still a struggle, but people bring in all these... wonky formats that they've been editing in on their home cameras and home systems, and then we try to get it all to fit into one playlist.
Years ago, I interviewed Shenok Asofu, who used to be the director of the Geophysical Institute, the university. This is back in the 1970s, and one of his jobs in 1957, the International Geophysical Year, was to assemble movies from Japan, Russia, and the United States. Of the night sky, he discovered the auroral oval in this process.
Oh, wow.
That it was actually an oval, but the some of it was 25 frames per second, some of it was 30 frames per second, different aspect ratios in the film, and all kinds of weird stuff. And he managed to splice all this up and get it playing on different projectors that he bought so that he could lay the sky up and see what the whole thing was, so that I can understand the confusion of all of those different formats and everything.
Well, that's a cool project.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a discovery, too.
Yeah.
Because nobody understood that the aurora actually makes an oval. So it was film that did that. It was pictures that do that. Because sometimes you can't discover what's going on.
You can learn a lot from a moving image.
Put the film together, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which brings up a point. You've been making films for a while.
Yeah.
What have you learned?
beyond technical skills?
I'm just curious.
I don't know. You learn a lot about people and about telling a story and sort of the progression of how that goes. You learn the technical skills as well, but those sort of evolve and change over the years.
I think the biggest thing I learned was how to tell a story in not 10 minutes? How to distill it into a couple
to
minutes.
To bring it down to 2 minutes. Yeah,
to fit it in festivals, festivals, and so people don't get bored.
It's got to be real closely related to short story writing, where you have just a few pages usually, and you have to put... You have to somehow bring people right to the point and then move the plot forward and get it all done in like 3 or 4 or 5 pages.
That's the plan, I guess.
Yeah, you'd be amazed what you can accomplish in 5 minutes. It's really, I mean, you can tell a pretty complex story in the 5 minutes and have a scene with a lot of emotion in it, and you start to understand characters, and it's really, it's a nice approachable slice for a local film festival, because you're not... I feel like a lot of first-time filmmakers set out to make a feature film and get in way over their heads when they should be, you know, trying to do something that's more in the like 5 to 10 minute range, and doing that really well instead of muddling through something that's longer. And I know that from, that's something I learned. That's a mistake I made. You know, in college we tried to make a feature film and it was awful. It was just a slog. It was a horrible process and a lot of organization and not a lot of actual filmmaking.
It's a terrible question, but I'm thinking about somebody who's sitting there thinking, you know, that really sounds interesting, but I don't have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
What would you advise? Do they just take the camera and go start shooting?
There are a ton of people that have ideas. You know, I think everyone's got an idea for a film, and if you don't have an idea, turn to the guy next to you.
Stop somebody on the street.
Yeah. We have a lot of people that come in that it's something that we haven't done very well yet, but that we hope to do, is to help people find those partnerships. We have a lot of people that come in that say, hey, I've got a camera, but I don't know what to shoot, or I've got a script, but I don't have anyone to make it, or I've got, you know, this kind of, those sort of pieces, and we're trying to connect people, but that doesn't always happen.
Lou, have you entered the festival yourself?
Yeah, I throw stuff in once in a while.
Okay, but you've made a lot of films.
Not as many as Pat. He's a little bit more prolific about it.
But have you watched the films in the festival?
Oh, yeah, I watch almost all of them.
What would you say, can you remember a film that just really struck you as being an amazing piece of footage? Footage is an old term, but...
You know, there's just so many to choose from over these last... 10 years that we've been doing this.
I really like George's music video he did last time around. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Can you kind of describe it?
He just did this really stark black and white. It was like a score for a movie almost. It was this black and white film, and he edited together some of the footage, and it was pretty, really powerful. He did another one that was like this. What was the Japanese one? Tokyo, and that one was a lot of fun too. But yeah, George Kuhar has been doing some really cool music videos. We get a lot of cool, like, ski and snowboard footage. A lot of great nature footage. Yeah. Actually, Skip Gray, who you probably know from the station here, did some incredible underwater footage. They just shot with like a GoPro, and it was salmon swimming around. He put some music on it, and I really was impressed by that footage. Mm-hmm. I remember being kind of blown away by that.
So how about the audience? How many people come to the festival?
We usually get a pretty full house, and we do about 5 shows.
Probably about
60 to 90
people per screening.
Okay.
We have a show on Thursday and 2 on Friday and 2 on Saturday usually, but we might do a Sunday screening this one.
Okay, so it's like 300 to 400 people every, and that's twice a year. We do a summer festival and a winter festival. And then we also host events. We try to bring people into town to do workshops and things like that. We've got a guy who's come here a lot named Warren Etheridge, and we're going to try and bring him back in September to do another workshop. We've worked with screenwriters, animators, illustrators, all kinds of people, and brought them to town. It's, for me personally, I really want to learn from people that are better than me. And in this town, there's not a lot of industry. And so I don't have all those connections. You've got some great people like Joel Bennett and Dave Hunsaker, but there aren't a ton of those people here. And so to bring people in occasionally is better for the community than if I go out to something. So, you know, it's about the same cost. Might as well fly someone here, feed them some fish, and show them around.
Yeah.
And you get a better experience out of
it. Take them out of the glacier and get hot tips on how to make movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of equipment does someone have to have to do this?
Not much. I mean,
what's
you can
like
do it
the
on your,
minimum?
You can do it on your cell phone. You don't really need... I mean, I've seen some amazing cell phone
films. It's become a lot more accessible over the last 10 years.
Yeah. I think there's another interesting facet here. I was thinking about this the other day, that things that show up on the internet now, on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that stuff, when you look at it, you realize that what it was somebody raising up his iPhone and shooting the guy on the stage. And, you know, it's terrible quality, but insane content. Because you're somewhere, you know, there's a ton of content
out there. That is interesting. It's you almost have a more personal experience when you see something through a cell phone than when you see it for like a really polished production. You feel a little bit removed if you watch something that's really well produced. It creates a barrier.
Yeah.
But when you're watching something that's a little bit shaky, a little bit handheld, a little bit grainy, it feels like you're immersed in it a little more sometimes, which is an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that technique is used now a lot in documentaries.
A lot of scary movies use that.
Yeah, too, yeah. For sure. Mm-hmm. Since that, what was the film that...
Blair Witch Project started that.
Yeah,
but yeah, there are a lot of them use that sort of shaky cam to help you immerse in the film more. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get the dates and times here. One more time, the deadline is the last day of July, right?
The deadline is the 26th. 26th of July, Thursday the 26th,
okay.
And that's really the big date that we just want people to know right now. The festival is going to be the first weekend of August.
Okay.
If you're interested in submitting a film, if you've got an idea for a film, go to jumpsociety.org, that's our website. There's information, there's submission forms, there's information on the festival there, and that's where we post all of our updates.
And basically you got a month to finish it up and...
Yeah, which is plenty of time. I know people that do them in the weekend. So
usually we're a lot later in telling people about this.
Outstanding. Okay, and, thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 26th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of Pearl S. Buck, born Hillsborough, West Virginia, 1892. Her parents were Christian missionaries in China. They came back to this country for the birth of the baby, but when she was 3 months old, they headed back to China. Her father, Absalom, was a fundamentalist Presbyterian. In the villages where he traveled to preach, he was the first white person the villagers had ever seen. He estimated that over the course of 10 years, he converted about 10 people to the faith. They were very poor. They lived in the city of Zhenchang. They lived in 3 crowded rooms in an apartment, one of the poorest sections of the city, a district full of prostitutes and drug addicts, got only a small stipend for their work as missionaries. And Absalom set about trying to translate the New Testament into Chinese. He spent 30 years working on it, edition after edition, revising to make it more perfect as the family slipped deeper and deeper into poverty. Chinese was the girl Pearl's first language. Her Chinese nurse told her bedtime stories about dragons and tree spirits. She wandered through the countryside and the city and the streets and the markets, watching puppet shows, eating Chinese food. She had blue eyes and blonde hair, but she didn't let that hold her back. She joined in local celebrations and funerals and parties. She taught knitting at a shelter for girls and women who'd worked as prostitutes, and the women told the young American girl all their stories of rape and abuse and violence. And then she came back to this country, to Randolph-Macon Women's College in Lynchburg, Virginia. She was a complete misfit. Graduated from college, went back to China, met an American agricultural economist, married him, John Buck, gave birth to a daughter. Things started to fall apart. Her daughter had a rare developmental disability. The political situation in China was very tense. The marriage fell apart. She moved back to this country with her 9-year-old daughter and put her into an institution in New Jersey. Pearl Buck did not have enough money to pay for the tuition, so she started writing. She wrote a novel called East Wind, West Wind, which did not sell well, and the following year she published The Good Earth. 1931 it came out. It was a huge bestseller. She won the Pulitzer Prize and a few years later the Nobel Prize in Literature. Pearl Buck said, "My earliest knowledge of story came to me in China. Story belongs to the people because their senses are unspoiled and their emotions are free." Here's a poem for today by Tennessee Williams entitled Clover. "These are fragrant acres where evening comes long hours late, and the still unmoving air cools the fevered hands of fate. Meadows where the afternoon hangs suspended in a flower, and the moments of our doom drift upon a weightless hour. And we who thought that surely night would bring us triumph or defeat, only find that stars are white clover at our naked feet." A poem by Tennessee Williams, Clover, from the collected poems of Tennessee Williams, published by New Directions, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Goddard College, offering low residency education for adult learners since 1963. Now offering both bachelor's and master's degrees in Port Townsend and Seattle, Washington. Learn more at goddard.edu. And by CenturyLink, linking Americans and Fortune 500 companies to what matters most. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. Produced by Nick Vetter, written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Sale presents the annual Only Fools Run at Midnight. Run, walk, or wheel 5K or 1 mile June 30th at 11:59 p.m. Pre-register by June 28th at First Bank, JRC, Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, Pavitz, the sale office, or online at saleinc.org. Race night registration starts at Centennial Hall at 10:30 p.m. Dress in costume, compete for best centipede, and win prizes. For more info, call 586-4920. Sale, inspiring personal independence.
23 and a half minutes before 4 o'clock. My next guest is going to talk to us about a program called Get Out the Boat.
It's true.
I love the name of it. This is Ruth Coste.
Hi.
So, get out what boat?
Get out the boat. Well, you know, the Southeast Alaska Sailing, or SEAS, club has a weekly Get Out the Boat event. We actually have two of them. We have one here in the Gastineau Channel on Wednesday nights at 6 o'clock, and one that's out at for the Auk Bay boats on Friday nights at 7. And it's just a great, really encouraging people just to get out and use their sailboats. And, you know, this last weekend, of course, was a great, you know, this Wednesday night ended up being just beautiful. The sun came out.
Wasn't that amazing?
It was just, you know, there were several boats out that night. It was fun to kind of sail around. We don't race on Wednesday nights or, you know, or Fridays in Auk Bay, but it's more just, you know, a good time to kind of practice stuff and figure out, you know, how your boat works if you're new to it, or try out some new sails, try out some new crew. And
when we had that big front move in, that was, there were some pretty powerful winds there.
There was. I know. I was biking in it.
Yeah.
It was on Sunday when that kind of came back and pushed us. Push that wind in.
Yeah.
That would have been a little bit much to sail in.
Yeah,
was...
I think so. Some of those gusts were hurricane force. I think I was watching my trees whip around pretty heavily. But short of that, what's ideal?
What's ideal? You know, I've been sailing up here in Juneau for only about 3 years now. This is my third season up here, so I'm still learning that. And but you know, if you get about, you know, any wind at all is helpful, but, you know, 5 to 10 is usually a nice breeze to get going. Once you start to get up over that, you really got to work. It's fun, but you really got to work, too.
And I think sailing here requires a little bit different equipment than it does in some other places. I see a lot of boats out with spinnakers or larger front sails like that.
Yeah, well, the different sizes of sails and stuff, too, depends on how much wind there is. You know, if there's less wind, you get a bigger sail, and if there's more wind, you kind of want a smaller sail so you have a little more control. The spinnakers are great here for, especially because a lot of times in the channel, the wind will be going, you know, really hard in one direction, and so you've got this narrow channel, and if you get the wind behind you, it's great to just fly a spinnaker and go downwind.
I maybe somebody doesn't know, that's basically a big sail.
It's a big kind of a parachute,
kind of creates almost a globe in front of the boat.
Yeah,
when
it's really
got it tied off. Yeah.
It's a really lightweight fabric, kind of like a parachute type of fabric, so it really picks carries the wind very easily.
Yeah, so it really gives you some speed.
Yeah.
But you have to have the wind behind you in order to make it work at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, how many boats are coming out when you have one of your get out the boat events?
Well, this last Wednesday when it was really nice out, there was about four or five boats, other sailboats out in the channel around. Typically, we've seen this season so far two or three. It's been hard because the weather's been rough, and so people are a little, requires a little more, I guess, rain gear and gumption to get out in that kind of weather. But it's still fun, even when it's raining. You can have a good time.
If you don't have a boat, the way they say that you sail is to get on crew.
How
does SEAS help people get on crew?
Well, the best way is to go to our website, and there's a little thing to click on our website, looking to crew, I think is what it says, or something like to that effect. And you can sign up to get on the mailing list. Another way to do is we have a Facebook page now. If you just search Southeast Alaska Sailing on Facebook, you'll find our Facebook page, and that would be a good place. We're still ramping that up. That one's kind of new, so we're trying to get that more active. But that would be a good way if you don't hear back right away from the website to kind of poke people on there. I know I'm on there every day monitoring what's going on the Facebook page, and so I could help as well kind of connect people with some skippers who have boats and are looking for crew.
You don't have a boat yourself,
I
right?
do not have a boat myself.
But
it
doesn't seem to have stopped you at all.
It has not. I sail pretty regularly on a boat called Haiku out of Douglas Harbor, although I have sailed around on some other boats, too. It's always good to get experience on different boats, especially when you're learning. It's kind of fun. Every boat's a little different.
So just because you don't own a sailboat does not mean you can't be an active member of SEAS.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, are there any events coming up that people should know about?
Yeah, we've got we're just not quite halfway through our racing series, which happens on the weekends throughout the summer months. We've had, I think, four races so far, and our next race coming up is a day race on July 7th, and it's a skipper's choice, which means that morning on the 7th, the skippers who are racing will get together, and based on conditions, we'll decide. I think we can race around Grand Island, I'll race to Jaw Point in Taku Inlet, or race around back of Douglas to around Point Hilda area. And they'll decide that on the 7th, and that's just an all-day race. And then coming up on July 21st to the 23rd, there's going to be a really nice long weekend cruising race to Funter Bay. And that one's going to start more out of Auk Bay. Most of our races throughout the season tend to start out of the channel, but that one's going to start out of the Auk Bay area by favorite channel. And it's going to race to Funter Bay and have a day of just hanging out and having fun in the bay and then racing back on Monday.
Okay, so leaves what day?
Leaves on Saturday.
Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a day to just enjoy.
So if you get wind behind you, how long does it take to get from here to Funter?
I haven't ever been here for that race.
So
I'm not a good one to ask for that.
We need an experienced sailor to tell us the answer
true.
To that question,
it's,
right?
It's no more than, most of our day races are about 8 or 9 hours at the most.
Okay, sailing out and then the rest of the day kind of relaxed and chilling and then coming back.
Hanging out.
Cool. So a day race on July 7th. If people do not have their own boats, they should go to the website and see who's asking for crew.
And if
nobody's asking, then put themselves up and say, I'd be really interested in going. And like
And get out the boats are a good way to get a sense, though, because you don't want your first day to be on a boat with a new skipper to be, all day stuck in a boat. Once we're going, there's no getting back.
No helicopter trips off of the thing.
It's true.
Okay. Do you have membership? Do people join SEAS?
People do join SEAS. There is a membership component to it, especially for the boats that are sailing. There's a membership, and you can get a little thing when you become a SEAS member. It's called a Burgee.
The flag.
Yeah, the little flag.
Okay. Yeah.
And there are membership dues. I don't have, you know, that information on me.
Not an issue. I was just wondering if...
But there's information about that on the website as well.
And then you have social gatherings boats?
We do have social gatherings off the boats. On the multi-day races especially, we'll often raft up. A lot of times on Wednesday nights, we will, after racing, everybody will kind of meander over to the Island Pub afterwards and hang out. We do usually a party in the spring and one again in the fall to kind of bookend the season and just talk about what the season was like. And every once in a while we'll arrange to have like a little raft up to sail down if the weather's really nice out on a night, just sail down the channel a bit and raft up and barbecue and and just hang out. So yeah, it's as much a social club as it is a racing club. It's all about having fun sailing and and just
Will the club do anything on the 4th of July or 3rd of July?
We're not, you know, we won't be. We were part of the Marine Maritime Festival. Uh-huh. You could get on a boat and see some sailboats then, but we will not be part of the parade or anything. But we do have a race then the weekend after.
All right.
On the 7th.
On the 7th of July, day race to be decided by the captains when they assemble as to where it goes exactly, but it's an all-day event.
Yeah.
And if you're interested, crew up on the website.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much for keeping us posted on what's going on the sea around Juneau.
Thank you very much.
This is Bird Note. On a warm, sunny day, an American robin sits on the ground, its wings outstretched and its tail splayed behind. You look more closely and see that the robin is sitting astride an anthill, and that ants are swarming over its body. Occasionally, the robin even takes an ant in its bill and wipes the ant against the underside of its wings, a kind of avian spa treatment. This behavior, first recorded by John James Audubon in the 1830s, is known as anting. Although observed infrequently, anting has been recorded among more than 250 species of birds. Although most experts agree it has to do with transferring the ant's secretions, particularly formic acid, to the bird's body. It's likely that the ant's formic acid helps control feather mites and other parasites. Lacking ants, some birds have been seen using citrus fruits, mothballs, and even glowing embers to achieve the effects of formic acid. One clever bird, a rook, the British cousin of the American crow, even learned to strike a match, then touch the hot tip to its underwing. Bird Note's theme music was composed and played by Nancy Rumble and John Kessler. Our executive producer is Chris Peterson. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Twelve minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. It's going to look like tonight is rain, Wednesday night rain likely, Wednesday rain likely, Wednesday night mostly cloudy with scattered showers, mostly cloudy, brand new forecast, but essentially the same thing, rain and highs in the 50s. Mark Wheeler gave a presentation at Mudrooms, the event where we have seven speakers who speak each for 7 minutes or so. Here is Mark's presentation from earlier this year.
Mark Wheeler is our next speaker. Mark grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Like other Cajun men, he loves to eat good food and make it for others. Mark's lived in Juneau since 1995 and is a former grassroots organizer, member of the Juneau Assembly, and nonprofit executive director. He's now a stay-at-home dad and works part-time on research projects for Big Brothers Big Sisters from his home office. He says his wife, Jessica, should really be up here instead, but his impulses often get the better of him. As Amanda said, Mark produces audio for Mudrooms and is on our storyboard. Please welcome Mark.
Thank you. One of the benefits of doing the audio production is that I will be able to edit out any embarrassing moments from my talk tonight. Not really. I'm going to try to keep it real and wanted to dedicate my words tonight to my dear friend, John Cowett. Recently, my wife Jessica told me that I have too many hobbies. She might be right. Some of my current activities include unicycling, backyard chicken farming, home charcuterie projects, backcountry skiing, sous vide cooking in a makeshift coffee urn, skate skiing, deer hunting, DJing avant-garde jazz, and swimming in Gastineau Channel, and audio-video production. Yeah. And while my passions give me great joy, they have also at times swung the hinges of my life story. All through school, growing up, I loved math. For one thing, I was good at it, thanks to Montessori preschool. But I loved competing with my elementary school classmates on how many workbooks I could finish before them. But there was also a singular beauty. I loved the cleanness of numbers. There was no uncertainty. And when I was older, the joy of finishing a math proof and taking this mathematical problem and tying it up with a bow gave me a pleasing feeling of completion. But then I got to college, and I remember the first day of school in differential equations 3, my math professor came in and he had a suit and tie on, very straight-laced, obviously came from the engineering program. He said that this class was going to be so hard that we'd all have to study together in order to pass the class. It was clear to me it wasn't about the beauty of numbers, it was about weeding out the chaff. And upset on principle and not really wanting to consort with these other nerds, I made the financially astute decision to drop math right there and become an English major. Then I added history, and then I took enough Italian classes to have a major if my college offered one, including a year in Bologna. I wasn't really good at any of these subjects, but I thrilled at approaching the text with a critical eye, and I grew to enjoy the labors of writing. I read recently that math majors are the highest paid major coming out of college. How much did I make in my first job out of college? $2.40 a day. I was a volunteer ranger in Denali National Park. And there, living on the Toklat River, I kindled my passion for Alaska's wild lands. After Denali, I had a few crummy jobs back in Louisiana, like cooking the graveyard shift at Waffle House. Then I made my way back to Alaska and came to Juneau to work at Saga as an AmeriCorps volunteer. Talk about crummy jobs. The worst job experience ever had to have been transporting the contents of an outhouse in a makeshift stretcher to a dumping spot in the woods. I am still amazed I did not puke. But finally, I ended up in a job that I was passionate about, working at SEAC, fighting for the Tongass. And for those 5 years working with folks like Bart Kohler, I couldn't imagine being any more passionate about something than fighting for Port Hooton and Burners Bay and Tanaki Inlet. But then, a few years later, I find myself working at Big Brothers Big Sisters. And I couldn't imagine being any more passionate about something than working to help our community's vulnerable children. Yes, I've been motivated by my passions and have followed them and cultivated them without much thought to my fiscal future. With a solid nonprofit work history, I will surely be working until I die. And while they have helped shape the course of my life, none of these passions compares to the love I have for my children. I'm one of these men who have always wanted to have children. I don't know, maybe I wanted to see my genes continue to the next generation like some Darwinian urge. But I always somehow knew that this was a relationship that I could only have with my own flesh and blood. And if I didn't have this experience, I would be missing out on something dear and precious in my brief time on this planet. Luckily, I found someone willing to embark on this journey of parenthood with me. She's also my best editor-in-chief. Jessica and I had our first child, Celia, A little more than a year into our marriage. No. Okay. Okay. But I remember we had our first RC a little more than a year into our marriage. I have a really bad memory, but I remember clearly that day when they told us we had to leave the birth center and go back to our little house on 12th Street. I was the father lion protecting my cub from the bright, harsh world. I can remember taking those few steps to the house, and I was alert for any present dangers. And then someone came up to us, an acquaintance came and said, "Oh, when'd you have your baby?" They obviously thought it was a couple weeks ago we had our baby. She had no idea that I was about to get that child in the house and protect her with a big supply of Hibiclens. You'd think my steely gaze and my death-like grip on the child carrier would have given her a clue, but there's always time for sidewalk talk in Juneau. Say was born on Alaska Day, October 18th, like Dee said, and after a week of horse trading and indecision, we ended up naming her after Celia Hunter, a strong Alaska woman, the founder of our state's conservation movement. Having Celia enter my life changed me utterly. Being a dad was all that I imagined it would be, with far less sleep than I ever could have contemplated. And working for kids at Big Brothers Big Sisters, I became a big bag of tears. It was bad. I embarrassed my staff constantly. I would cry at staff meetings. It's terrible. Every child I heard a sad story about was Celia in my mind. And the apex of my emotional fragility came at an award ceremony where I bawled like a baby in front of thousands. After 3 more years of discussion, Jessica and I decided to have our second child. Part of me doubted whether I could ever love another being as much as Celia. I didn't think my heart was big enough. But you know, the heart is an incredibly flexible organ. And when Ferguson came into our life, my heart grew to fit his love just fine. This time it took us 10 days to name Ferguson. Last was 7 for Celia. And I just can't imagine my life without Ferguson. Every year since he's been a little baby, Ferguson's had the croup. I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but it's terrible. He has this seal-like cough and this whistling sound with his larynx constricts, and it really scares us to death. I'm getting there. And every time Ferguson has this croup, I have to go into his room at night, sneak in, and feel his warm breath on my hand. Now Celia's 8, just getting to the age where I can embarrass her, like tonight, and Ferguson's 4. My most important job right now is being their dad. Sure, I have a 3/4 time day job that's fulfilling, and I even get the use of my statistical skills, and I have a litany of hobbies, but nothing rewards me more than my work as a parent. I didn't plan on being a work-at-home dad at this time in my life, but events conspired to make it possible. Thank you, sweetie, for letting me have this job and for getting us health insurance while you sleep on schoolroom floors in Savunga and Chivac. The other day, my daughter had been stewing. At the end of it, she said that nobody cared about her. It hurt me to the bone. How could she think this? How could she think that I didn't care for her? How could she not know that I cared for her and Ferguson more than anything else? So tucking her into bed that night, I told her how much I cared for her. I told her I cared for her more than even my own life. It was probably too heavy, but I said that I would give my life for hers. It's not funny. Yes, it is. And my parents never told me this, but I knew it was true. I mean, when we were driving in the car, my mom's arm would always shoot out when a car came out in front of us. My dad, who got called up for the Army in high school to go to Italy, always told me that if we went to war with Russia, he would go in my place. And I wanted Celia to know that love, too. I'm not the perfect dad. I lose my temper way too much. And I probably use the electronic babysitter way too often, but it's the best job I've ever had. And this time I know I won't be as passionate about any other job. Thank you.
Mark Wheeler's mudroom presentation last year.
I was taught the importance of respect for my family, respect for myself. Today, I see domestic violence and sexual abuse hurting our children. If you or someone you love is a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, there is help. Asking for help changes everything. Real Alaskans, choose respect.
Visit andvsa.org or call 1-800-799-SAFE.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau, but we're also on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on 88.1 K201 AM. Soon Huna is served by K220BT at 91.9.